Hi there. It's me, Laura Wasser, the divorce attorney and the founder of It's Over Easy, the online divorce service. I've been practicing family law for over 20 years, and I've worked on thousands of divorces, shepherding people through what may be one of the most terrifying times in their lives. Along the way, I often have to remind people to lower their expectations. When dealing with matters of the heart, rules simply don't apply, because all's fair in love and war. So welcome to the All's Fair podcast. Fasten your seatbelts and let's go. Hi guys, I'm Laura Wasser and this is the It's Over Easy podcast, All's Fair.
Hey everyone, I'm Johnny Rains. I'm head of content at It's Over Easy.
We have an excellent show for you today. Let's talk a little bit about what's in the news. Considering a corona divorce, you're in good company. It was written by Kim Brooks, and in this opinion piece from the New York Times, one woman uses her own divorce story to examine the old-fashioned ideas of the nuclear family in America.
It's interesting in this article because she really does sort of point out that marriage in America is really not working, especially for families who have kids during the pandemic. She also talks about how the lack of companionship inside of marriages is really one of the reasons why they are falling apart.
And what I didn't totally understand about this article was, does she suggest that people should not be coupling, cohabiting, co-parenting? Or is she just saying they can do all that and not get married? Because what is really the difference besides the piece of paper, so to speak?
Right. Well, I think her point is that it's the two-parent household, or even two co-parents that are co-parenting. It's just not enough. Here's a paragraph from the article.
As married, is she encouraging the throuple again? Are we back to that?
Actually, yes, that we are back to that. Actually, she was looking lovingly at the HBO's drama Big Love.
Yes. A
moment of clarity came to her one evening while she and her husband were actually watching the show. And she asked her husband after watching it, she said, I need some sister wives. So that's the point, is that she wants more companionship. She says, as married couples spend months trapped in homes with partners and children, the cherished institution of the nuclear family begins to look increasingly unworkable and obsolete, while marriage begins to feel more and more like a two-legged stool. And you know you need three legs on a stool.
Right. I mean, again, I think that's fixable. I think that she needs to get some friends, maybe not sister wives, but, you know, how what we do it here on my block with Mary and Wendy, like, it does take a village. Right. And I think that people need to really realize that, because not being married doesn't really solve her problem, said the divorce attorney.
I'll tell you something else that doesn't solve your problems, and that's taking drugs. And apparently everyone, particularly parents, are taking a lot of drugs these days.
Yes. Parents' little helpers. We used to call them mothers' little helpers, but now they're parents' little helpers.
Wasn't it? I mean, opportunity.
It's basically about gummies, right? Like just people that are just can't get by without that afternoon glass of wine or the gummy. I know. I doubt I ever bathed my children without having at least half a glass of wine in me. I mean, you just taking the edge off at the end of the day. So this is by Jessica Gross. And in this Sunday Style story, she examines the increase in the use of substances like marijuana and alcohol by parents weary of raising children during this pandemic. And let me just tell you, I fucking get it, man. I do.
Are you weary?
Those folks who have been sober for years and remain sober throughout this, kudos to you. That's all I'll say.
The other point that they make in the article is that there is this sort of through line for moms in America from the 50s forward of sedating themselves and as you take a big drink of. Is that water, Laura?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just water.
So it's only
10.
Interesting article.
And finally, questions to ask before ending your relationship. This is by Amelia Nirenberg. And where's it from?
This is also from the New York Times.
Oh,
this
also
from the Vows section.
Okay. Oh, from Vows. Experts' advice on how to tell when and if you should break up during COVID-19. And I like what Johnny put in my notes. Spoiler alert, if you're reading this, you probably already know the answer.
It's time to break up. There are some really great tips in here. For example, if the world were easier, would you still want to be with this person? It's suggesting that you ask yourself these questions. First question is, if the world were easier, would you still want to be with this person? Second question, have your fights changed since the pandemic started? Meaning, have they gotten worse or have you started to care less? Number three, do negotiation and compromise feel like you're losing ground? And number four, would you think your friend should keep dating this person? Number five, if you could jump ahead to after the breakup, would you? So I think the time you get through that little quiz, you'll know whether it's time to break up or not.
And one thing about that last one, if you could jump ahead to the end of the breakup, I mean, yes, everybody would. It just really, really takes that time to get through it, to grieve it, to mourn it, to really begin to see the possibilities of your next chapter. So, you know, the only way out is through. And on that note,
it's not easy, but it's over.
Yes. Okay, Johnny. I think there comes a time in many relationships when you just know in your heart that you're done. And if you're married, being done usually means divorce, which is not scandalous or rare in most cases these days. The point that Kim Brooks made in the article Johnny and I were just discussing, that marriage isn't working for many Americans, particularly those trying to raise children, means something new is on the horizon. The American family structure is changing, and so is our country. The upcoming election, the critical decisions about our relationships, the pandemic, our lives online, the environment, it's a lot. Fortuitously, our guest today is adept at navigating relationships. Plus, she knows Washington, D.C. like the back of her hand. She was a protege of Nancy Pelosi's. And her experience with life online is, well, it's profound to say the least. She's one of the youngest women to be elected to Congress, and she served as the U.S. representative for California's 25th congressional district in 2018. But after an affair with a female staff member was made public and nude photos were published online, she resigned from Congress in 2019. Now she's using her platform to support young women running for office and to advocate for legislation to address cyber exploitation. Welcome to All's Fair, Katie Hill.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I love that you're here. And I love that you're here a week before Election Day. That's when this episode will drop. We got to get people out there voting.
100%.
Let's talk a little bit about your backstory, Katie. Your professional life before the midterm elections in 2018 was spent basically working with homeless people in Southern California, which is my lifetime stomping ground. How did that experience lead you to decide to run for office?
Well, I was the executive director of PATH, People Assisting the Homeless, which was the largest homeless services organization in California. And, you know, homelessness is not something that is caused by a single issue. It's the combination of so many factors, from income inequality to mental health and substance abuse issues to the criminal justice system and failures within society that lead to ultimately people ending up on the streets. And because of that, I worked on a number of policy related matters throughout my career in the industry. And the further along I got, the more I saw that even if we passed, you know, major funding measures to build housing for people experiencing homelessness or to fund services, if you didn't address the more systemic factors, then you were only going to be able to get so far. It's like bailing water out of a sinking ship. And so when Trump won in 2016, it became so clear that everything that we'd fought for was in jeopardy. Everything that mattered to me and to my colleagues and to the people that we were working to serve was all at risk. And I wanted to get involved. I wanted to, you know, be part of flipping the house in some way. And then I found out that the district that I'd spent my whole life in was key in us being able to take back the house. And so I thought, well, I want to get involved there, obviously. And then basically, I didn't like the candidate who was running. I didn't think he could win. And someone finally said, well, Katie, you should run. And I decided, well, let's give it a shot. And we ended up putting together this really scrappy grassroots campaign and ended up winning by almost 9 points. So yeah, it was pretty incredible.
I remember. I gave money to that campaign.
Well, thank you. You
made headlines that year when you flipped a Republican district mm-hmm. to blue. And Vice Magazine proclaimed you had run the most millennial campaign ever and documented your race as part of the surging wave of female candidates. What do you think, Katie, is different now about the way candidates are running in this year's election? I mean, I think some of that they knowingly or unknowingly really took from what you had done back in 18.
Yeah, I think so too. I think we're seeing people run really progressive campaigns that are not afraid of being young and that are not afraid of being really authentic and transparent and are kind of bucking the status quo. And we've seen, you know, upsets against both Republicans, you know, in primaries, you know, in open primaries where people are outperforming, Democrats are outperforming Republicans. but also even against Democratic incumbents too. So I think that we're seeing, you know, in a lot of ways, I feel like in 2018, our campaign, but many others across the country, sort of broke a lot of barriers for especially young people, people of color, LGBTQ individuals, and women to campaign more as ourselves and less in this kind of typical political norm.
And serve that way as well once once elected. So you had been serving for less than a year when the photos were published, and now that's all in the rearview mirror. But just give us a little something, because I remember going like, oh no, you know, and not oh no about anything you'd done, because frankly, it's not any of anybody else's business, but oh no, like who did this? This is so fucked up. If you can talk about it a little bit, because it is, I think, important for people to hear.
Yeah. So I had been with my now almost ex-husband for 15 years. And I had tried to leave him before the election even. He basically said that if you leave, I'm going to ruin you. After 6 months in Congress, I finally decided I needed to do it anyway. Well, I had had a consensual relationship with a woman who had worked on my campaign. And a few months after I left him, he basically, in conjunction with the right-wing media and with my political enemies, released photos that showed that relationship and that were of me naked, taken without my consent, certainly published without my consent. And they were published in Red State, which is a right-wing blog paper type thing, and in the Daily Mail. And, you know, it was an extension of the control that he'd exercised for a long time, of the abuse. And more than anything else, it was a takedown, right? And I think, you know, I have obviously had to replay this a million times, but at that point, I felt like my only option was to step down, and because I did not want to be a liability for my colleagues, it felt like there was no other way to make it end. And you know, my own mental health was really struggling with the release of those images, and at one point I was suicidal. So I ultimately stepped down, and the last year has been a recovery since then.
Absolutely, I read a really great expose in the New York Times probably over the summer. I'm sure you saw it. I mean, it was a good one. It talked about the things that you're doing since and all that. Do you think that experience would, I mean, we have seen so many things, Katie, and heard so many things about even our current president, but about males. I mean, you know, and yet somehow they're able to just overcome.
Yeah.
For a woman, it seems to be so much worse. And it also seems like we are so used to in our society saying like, oh, well, boys will be boys.
Yes.
But yet if it's a woman, the women are the worst criticizers. I'm sure all those, that Christian right was like, oh, can you imagine it? And with a woman and the hair brushing and whatever. And that poor man that she was married to who seems
like such
a jerk. I mean, is that changing? Will we see that change? Why is it that way? I'm sure you've examined this. I know I've seen things on Her Time about it. What can you say about that?
I think it is changing. I think it's especially changing with younger women, where we are recognizing the inherent sexism and misogyny in so many facets of life. But you're right, there are just not as many, you know, as women, we're relatively new to politics, right? We're certainly, by comparison, new to serving an elected office. And that means that we're relatively new to scandal. So, you know, the expectations have been so much higher for us in terms of the virtuosity and the quote unquote ethics and, you know, the behaviors. Like, men have been having affairs in politics and otherwise forever. And we just don't even bat an eye at it. I mean, when everything happened with Clinton, everyone blamed Monica, this 22-year-old intern, and not the other way around. And, you know, even now, we've just with other kinds of scandal, Ralph Northam never stepped down and he seems to be surviving that just fine. I think that there's a big difference just in terms of what we've seen, like what we've actually experienced women going through in terms of scandal. And I think that, you know, we struggle with imposter syndrome all the time, right? And whatever we're doing. And I think the same
like
thing
we're
is the case.
Like we're pretending to be someone that we're really not, and we don't, we shouldn't really be in that office or
in
that position.
Or that we don't belong, that we, you know, whatever it is, whether it's in executive level careers or in a number of different things. And certainly I think the higher you go in any kind of profession, the more you just have this kind of inherent, sometimes at least, self-doubt that's ingrained in and socialized into us. And when you are faced with that, when something like a scandal comes about, then we don't have this just immediate confidence of like, of course I belong here. And of course, the people who are making this a scandal are the ones that are wrong. You have that questioning of like, well, shoot, do I deserve to be here in the first place? Or at least that's how I experienced it. So I think it has to change. And the more, I've been really gratified and I guess relieved that so many women have come to my defense afterwards and now. And I hope that continues. And I hope that the next woman who's faced with a similar situation does not feel the need to resign.
I love that. I really do. And I feel like, look, there's two things. It's not just being a woman. It's also being a Democrat. We always seem to be the ones that are like, I don't want to hurt the party. I'm going to step down. Al Franken. And yet at the same time, I mean, you see the Republicans and men over and over again saying, well, you know what happened, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, in my opinion, I don't care who slept with who. You're doing your job. If it's not precluding you from doing your job, then I don't need to know whatever your extramarital situation is. And can we move on, please?
Yeah, I agree with that, no matter who it has to do. I mean, right?
Like, sure. I don't care about the Republicans
totally
either.
Yeah. I mean, if there's money, if there's like, if you get into the unethical side of things in terms of money or in terms of influence with lobbyists and like that, that's where I care.
Or if you're hurting somebody else. Right. I mean, if you're actually like, you know, not consensual things, but no, not in this instance. This is All's Fair with Laura Wasser. I'm Laura. And this election coming up is one of the most important ones that will be in our lifetimes. So we've invited someone who knows what it's like to run for political office and win. Her name is Katie Hill. Listen to this, and then we'll get back to our conversation.
Katie Hill was part of the Blue Wave in 2018.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Hill, and I am running to take out Steve Knight.
A 31-year-old first-time candidate who flipped a Republican-held seat in Los Angeles County.
Steve Knight just called to concede.
Becoming one of the first openly bisexual women in Congress. Hill was endorsed by President Obama, mentored by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and was co-chair of her freshman congressional class.
Sorry, this is my first time up here.
In October, websites published nude photos of her that Hill says came from her husband. They revealed a three-way relationship she'd had with a female employee on her campaign and accused her of sleeping with one of her staffers in D.C., which she denies. The scandal led her to resign after less than a year in office.
I'm leaving because I no longer want to be used as a bargaining chip. I'm leaving because I didn't want to be peddled by papers and blogs and websites used by shameless operatives for the dirtiest gutter politics that I've ever seen.
Hill's been through a lot. Since she quit, her mother had brain surgery, her brother died of an overdose, and Hill herself has been in lockdown like the rest of us. But now she's back.
Katie, you're a stud.
Thanks.
So, and your autobiography, She Will Rise, Becoming a Warrior in the Battle for True Equality, which is out now, came out in August of this year from Grand Central Publishing. How has that book been welcomed?
Oh, I've gotten really great feedback. It was really important to me to not just write a memoir, right? But to make it about, you know, these shared experiences that we as women have and how we kind of can dismantle the power structures that are holding us back. And so I talk about my experiences in the context of these battles that we need to fight and ultimately to use them as examples and talk about the way forward.
You started the book before your brother died, and then you finished it in 3 weeks, according to, I think, a Guardian article that we read. What gave you kind of the incentive to kind of push through and get it done? Because I can't imagine the year you had.
Yeah. So the deadline was supposed to be, basically, it was 2 weeks after, less than 2 weeks after my brother passed away. When he died, everything was obviously turned upside down, and I said, there's no way I can finish it that soon. But it was really important to me to be able to, I wanted to be able to publish it in time for the 100th anniversary of suffrage. And once he died, I, really had to kind of reflect on what was important. And I felt like I needed a purpose and I needed to kind of be able to process, somehow, and to keep pushing forward. And I end the book actually by talking about a letter that I got from his friend and, a girl that he'd been seeing. And that actually was part of what kept me going too. So I'm glad I did it. But now that the book is published and it's, you know, the tour has kind of, the virtual tour has kind of, you know, most of it has happened, at least the heavy parts of it have happened. Now I'm trying to take some time and space to, you know, I don't know, become human.
Yeah. Again. No, it's true. It's very easy to kind of compartmentalize and focus. My mom died last year. I think it took me a full year. It wasn't until this past summer that I was like, oh my God, I have to actually like focus on this grief and kind of get through it. And it was not fun at all. So I feel you. I mean, I want you guys listening to check out this book. NPR says that it aims to encourage women to run for office, and it's been called a guide for women breaking glass ceilings. What do you say to women who may have been, I mean, look, it's easy to say, I went through this, I'm here, I'm still standing, I'm rising. But what do you say to people who are like, I do find that a lot of, particularly Democrats, have kind of shied away from politics these days because of exactly this kind of a, what are they going to do? What's in my past? How are they going to rip me apart? It's very brave and very daunting. What would you tell young women if you really thought that they were someone who had a real promising career in politics and they were like, I don't know, I'm not sure I feel it?
So I am faced with this every day. And the thing that I say is that, you know what, the only way that we change things is if people like you do run, and that you could get hurt. But the more that you're out in front of it, the more that you know that this stuff is in your past, but you are going to own it anyway, and that you're going to say, you know, I am who I am, and I have no shame about the fact that I've, you know, taken pictures and sent them to people that, you know, I've had consensual relationships with. And if that comes out, that's not on you. That's, I guess, the part that I wish I had felt more kind of, I don't know, confidence in of you know, knowing that it wasn't my fault, knowing that I was a victim of a sex crime, really.
Yeah.
So I guess I say, like, yes, this is the worst that can happen, but it really is the worst that can happen. Like, it couldn't get much worse than what happened to me. And I'm still telling you, should run. So.
Exactly. I like that. Let's talk for a minute about Her Time. I get the alerts on my phone. I totally love it. Tell our listeners, and what I do every time there's elections, I will not always do the groundwork myself, but I'll go in and I'll figure out, because I have a lot of young women that work at my firm. You know, Jen, I know a lot of young women who we made, and men too, by the way, who don't necessarily have the time to look into every, you know, question or incentive that's on the ballot, and certainly not all of the nominees. So tell us, because at some point I will be putting together something to send out to anybody who's interested. Who are the candidates that Her Time is endorsing?
So we have a number. We're endorsing in congressional races, but we're also even endorsing, we've got some Senate candidates that we're endorsing, and we're even endorsing down ballot. So there's too many for me to name all of them. So I would encourage people to go to her-time.com for our full list. But there are some really exciting folks that are in red to blue races, where these are districts that are really tight, competitive seats that could flip from red to blue and could you know, help expand our majority. But they're also young women, diverse candidates. These are people who we want as leaders in our party and leaders within our country, regardless of the fact that that we could be taking Republican seats too. A few that are really top of mind are in Texas. I think Texas is a huge battleground state this time. So Candace Valenzuela is in Texas 24. Gina Ortiz Jones, I can't remember her district number right now, but she's awesome. And there are just so many across the country that we've chosen to highlight, and I'm really, really excited about them. I think that we're gonna have a solid showing in November.
Good. Please go to her-time. Look at those lists. Follow it, because it's a really, really great resource. So I know a lot of times our parents, at least when I was growing up, would talk about, where were you when you found out JFK was shot? Where were you when you found out Ruth Bader Ginsburg died?
I was on a road trip. I think I was driving from, I was driving to Montana. And it's funny because I'm back in Montana now, but.
I see behind you. I see that. Looks like we're about to get into the next episode of Yellowstone.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's very close by, but, I was driving to Montana and I'd been out of service, and I got a text message from one of my friends, and she's like, oh my God, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. And I was like, no, I just had this horrible sinking feeling. And you know, then people are always asking me, like, what do we do? What does this mean? And I'm like, I'm still figuring that out too. But you know, we can't give up hope, and there's the biggest thing is going to be us not only winning this election, but winning it big.
Yeah.
And the more we win by, the more of a mandate it is, the more that we know that we're, you know, that even if it's not something that Democrats want to do, like, we're going to have to expand the court if that's what it takes. So,
yep.
But if we don't win, obviously we can't do anything. But if we only win by a small margin, it's going to be that much harder. So the more we win in every single state, across the board, then, the better served we'll be.
And I do feel like I've heard from so many people that I've asked that question when we're just talking about, there was this sense of despair, this sense of, oh my God, one more thing in 2020, life sucks, everything's terrible. And then I feel like so many people the next day were like totally energized and inspired and like, okay, now we're coming out fighting. This is what she would have wanted. We have to work even harder. And I'm hopeful that people will stay on that tip to kind of keep it going. Totally. For me, it also was Rosh Hashanah. It was the Jewish New Year. That's there was that time period. I mean, we had people coming over for dinner, socially distanced, but my family was with me and I was weeping. There was a lot of tequila. And so it took a little while to get more energized the next morning. Definitely this is not the time to give up hope.
No, we can't afford to. We just can't.
All right, so this is the time in the show when we do what we call the interrogatories, okay?
Okay.
So, Katie Hill, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Which relationship in your life has had the most profound impact?
There's so many. It's all with my family. I would say the relationship with my mom, because, you know, she's been such a role model for me. She's the person that is there no matter what, that I can always count on, who will tell me exactly what I need to hear and who gives me the strength to keep going, even though she's just faced so much adversity and just keeps showing up and is, you know, stronger than anyone I know.
She was a nurse, right?
She still is. Yeah. And
still is a nurse. Even during COVID, even after all the cancer. Oh my goodness. Yep, and dad was a cop.
He's about to retire, but my mom is, she's actually now a house supervisor, which means she runs the hospital on the night shift. And so she went at less than six months after brain surgery and after her son died, and during COVID, she's back doing that. And
now we see where you got your stud genes from, both parents, apparently. What's your favorite love song?
I really like Wonderful Tonight by Eric Clapton. I saw that question was coming up and I was like, I think that's the one.
I like that. Yeah. What's the one piece of advice you'd share with your 20-something-year-old self? Most of our guests have to go back a lot further than you to remind themselves.
Don't get married. Definitely don't get married in your 20s. Maybe in your 30s, but don't get married in your 20s.
I like it. And which romantic comedy could you watch on repeat?
That's a good one. I might have to get back to you on that one. Let me think about it more.
Okay. Thank you for your service and your bravery and your awesomeness and all you're doing today to make our country and our world a better place. I'm proud. My 10-year-old who's doing, you know, remote learning, came down and he poked in and like looked at you and he was like, is that her? And I was like, yeah, that's her. Tell people where they can find you online, where we can find your book and get more information about her time as we approach this election, please.
Sure. So I personally am the most active on Twitter and my handle is Katie Hill, the number 4CA. So Katie Hill 4CA. And I am, so her time is her-time.com. The book is, and all the social handles are on all the websites too. So the book is shewillrisebook.com, has everywhere you can buy it. It's also got resources on like domestic violence, on how to get involved in different things, including equal pay and all kinds of different stuff. And then the last one is nakedpoliticspodcast.com, which is the new podcast that's coming out starting probably next week.
Very exciting. We will tune in. We will listen. Thank you so much for being with us. I know you're crazy busy. You rock. I don't know what else to say. I'm like so proud to be a woman and have you like coming up and rising, as you said. So thank you for being with us.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Katie. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, she was amazing. I love her. Jesus Christ. You know what I thought, what I was struck by, and this may be a generational difference or an age difference.
What's that?
She didn't seem angry. I would have been so pissed at my husband. I mean, seriously? I've had people say to me, boyfriends, you know, like, I'm going to take you down. I'm going to go against you. But I never really believed them because ultimately they were people that I had loved or shared children with. And so I never really thought that that could happen. And Right. Wow, I mean, yeah. What a dick. If what you're listening, which I'm sure you're not, you're a dick.
Yeah. And, but you know, the thing is, she did love him. They were married.
Yes.
And that kind of betrayal to me is just like the worst thing. I don't know how she, like you said, how she's obviously worked through the anger. She's worked through a lot to get to this place of strength.
And one more thing that I will also say, and maybe this is just because I'm an older person, but remember my dad taught me two things growing up. One,
yes.
If you can't carry it, don't pack it. And two, don't let anyone take naked pictures of you. Now, again, maybe that's a new thing. She said, don't be embarrassed about it. It's okay, whatever. I'm just thinking that I don't really want anyone taking naked pictures of me. Here I am.
Especially at this age.
Check me out. Exactly. And then let it just be an image in your head. And also, I'm not sending any naked pictures of myself to anyone else. And no. Yeah, just saying. Anyway, good conversation. Guys, can you please go vote? Can you just please go vote? Again, if for no other reason that if you don't vote, you can't complain later, okay? You can't be one of the ones going, well, I voted and so this happened, or well, I, you know, go vote. We worked really hard to get that right. Go do it. Women, men, black, white, brown, go fucking vote. We'll talk to you soon. I'm Laura Wasser. This is All's Fair.
And I'm Johnny Rains. Thanks so much, everyone.
Bye.